The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello, welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. How is my co-host today, Tom Craggs? How are you doing, Tom?
I'm very good, Sean. How are you?
I'm very well, very well. Just sitting in Dorset. We're both in the southwest this weekend. We're not in the same...
Oh, you're back in the UK? Actually, we're on the phone. I hadn't realised you were back in the UK.
I'm back here, yeah.
Welcome home.
Thank you, yeah. I'm enjoying being back. It's lovely. I've been for one run. I brought back the wrong shoes because there's not that many places to run that are on road here down in Bridport. So I've been slipping and sliding all last night when I'm out for a run. And I'm going to get out for one in a minute when we jump off the record. But yeah, it's so nice. It's so nice to be back. It's not flat. It's different. The Amsterdam is just getting a bit boring. There's the complete flat landscape. It's nice to have a bit of a hill and that sort of thing. And so it's really nice to be back. How about you? You been out training this morning?
I tell you what, like, the lot, I won't go, nobody wants to hear about my boring running particularly, but the last 3 years, honestly, I can't blame having a child and a sleep deprivation, because ultimately my partner Georgia is has been running an awful lot better, and she's the one who's obviously dealing with the very worst of the fatigue. So I can't blame that, unfortunately, but the last 3 years has been... my body has been ravaged, absolutely ravaged, yeah, with niggles and injuries. Most recently, a bit of a plantar, what I think is a bit of plantar fasciitis. So I'm always a bit cautious about that. So I stopped. So the last few days I've been off, but going down the gym, and I it's nothing serious. So next few days, provided the pain is gone and everything's fine, lots of calf muscle stretching, everything else, I should be out running, and be nice to get out through Christmas. It feels strange to have Christmas and not head out and do a bit of running. So yeah, I'll be out.
Nice.
Otherwise, I've been on the bike, coaching, standing by tracks, you know, sitting on bikes. And everything else, so watching other people run for the most part.
Yeah. Who are you coaching sort of directly at the moment? Who are you working with, kind of where you are?
So I've just started, actually, over the last month, coaching Bournemouth. So the athletics club down here. We've been living in Bournemouth for well over a year now, and I've been coaching in Winchester before. So it's just been a case of sort of gradually building a relationship with the club, rather than me just walking in and going, you know, what can I do?
Right, where's my athletes?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because there was already some good stuff going on there, of course. So that's just started off. So that's the kind of club-based stuff. And then I've got athletes, obviously, still around Winchester and still locally to here that I coach sort of one-to-one who aren't necessarily a part of the club here. So I see those guys reasonably regularly too. I was out this morning with a couple of them. So yeah, it's busy but good.
Yeah, and do you prescribe Christmas Day Park Run? Is that on your training plan? Do you get people going down there?
I definitely get people. I tell you what, it's probably not, unless somebody specifically said, like, I really want to go and do Park Run on Christmas Day. But it's probably not on my. I'm trying to think. I don't think there's anybody who I've got. My partner Georgia might go out and do a park run on Christmas Day, but actually I don't think anybody else. Just I think mainly principally because of family circumstances, but definitely if they're up for it, sure. I would imagine pretty much everybody. I can't think of anybody that I'm coaching that isn't down to run on Christmas Day, but I have to say that I've been kind to not set anybody, like, you know. a hard 10 by a K or anything. 2400s or anything. But yeah.
Wasn't it was it Daley Thompson that used to say he used to know everyone else was training once a day on Christmas, so he makes sure he trained twice a day on Christmas Day just to prove himself that he was doing more than everybody else, so he was better prepared than everyone else when it came around. Just as a mental thing, but I don't know if that's true.
Sounds like a Daley Thompson thing. There's the old kind of story about Seb Coe and Steve Yvette that always goes around at this time of year, where there was that sort of set. I think it was Seb going out twice because he knew that. He knew that Steve would probably be doing the same or whatever. So I think that's, I think it's just part of the mindset, isn't it? Ultimately, most of us, we run on Christmas Day because we like to run every other day anyway. So it doesn't really make any difference. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I guess it's less a case of like, oh, I feel like I've got to get my run in before I go and kind of stuff myself silly, and more just, this is like what we do every day. So why change a habit and something you enjoy doing just because it's Christmas? So.
Exactly. Well, I'm going to do the park run tomorrow morning. So that's the 21st. We're recording on the Friday. So I'm going down to Bridport Park Run to try and have a go. I haven't done a hard session. I haven't done anything quicker than a 4-minute K for probably 2 to 3 months now, because I had some illness, I had some problems with some blood test results that were really low, and things just were, I think, because of, like you, with the baby fatigue. And actually, my main problem was, which is, I'll have to talk about on another show, was I wasn't eating enough. So I've been probably under fueling, not getting enough sleep, and I got really ill. So I've been taking 3 months of just jogging. But my first hard session back is this tomorrow morning, and I'm actually pretty worried about it. It's gonna be a tough old burnout. I should have done at least some strides before. Well, I had done some strides, but I should have done a bit of work before this.
You've got 15 minutes warm up and a few strides to do tomorrow morning. What more prep do you need? You'll be fine. No, I must be fit. I mean, ultimately, like, I think this is that you haven't got as good as you have in your running career without enjoying a like competitive moment and kind of enjoying pushing yourself and enjoying working hard. And actually, like, I have to say, the injuries, of course, I just miss running, like, you know, running easy, running steady, whatever, but I do miss the hard sessions, I do miss racing, I do miss that feeling of, like, you know, and God, so to be honest, mate, like, so what if you blow up? Doesn't matter, just go and join running hard again. You're feeling healthier, are you?
Yeah, much healthier. Yeah, Martin Cox, who's been coaching me, he really sort of was meticulous in getting to the bottom of what was going wrong. Because every year, pretty much, I run really well early season. And in 2014, when I ran my best ever year, I was really light, and I was probably not eating enough. But that has short term success. So I ran really well at the nationals and stuff. Yeah. Ran really well, but then I kind of followed the same pattern every year since. But it doesn't have the same success then. So I was training really hard, but probably a little bit of dieting in those hard months. Just not really thinking about it. Not excessively dieting, because I eat quite a lot, but just I wouldn't increase the amount of calories I was taking on in heavy volume weeks. Yeah. I'd almost keep it the same. So I wasn't recovering from those big weeks. And then I'd get ill when the big race came around. And it was a pattern that followed for years and years and years. And I think Martin's really helped in kind of going through everything that I was doing and getting to the bottom of it, and now hopefully I'm loving eating. So this Christmas is going to be amazing for me.
Good. It's probably good.
Yeah.
That is what coaching should be. Do you know what I mean? Like, we talked about this last time you and I chatted on a podcast about, you know, good coaching is understanding that health underpins performance. And sure, you can ignore health for short periods of time, one season, maybe even 2 seasons, if you're lucky, 3 seasons, but eventually you're going to start to plateau, break down, pick up injuries or underperform in key races. And sometimes, like, the brave athlete and the brave coach are the ones who go, you know what, this is just going to take, we need to give you a foundation and a platform that sets you up for, you know, several years worth of progression, not just, you know, one good race because you've your weight's right on the limit, and you know, I'm kind of overtraining you, and I know that I'm just delaying a point. I'm trying to delay a point at which your body breaks down. So no, it sounds good, mate.
Onwards and upwards.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I was going to say we've come into the end of our feature this month on diversity. So we started this kind of new format where we're looking at themes for a series of shows and talking about the different kind of factors and interviewing different people in relation to that theme. And it's been diversity this month. So We've had some really interesting interviews. We've talked to Charlie Dark. We've had a chat with Harminder Singh. We've got an interview here we're going to come round to in a second. But it's been really interesting because I put the post up on Twitter, I think it was. It might have been LinkedIn maybe, about is running too white. There was a Runner's World article a couple of years ago. And I had a weird reaction. Like, some people were like, yeah, this is a great thing to discuss. Others were like, this is just clickbait. What are you talking about? It's the most inclusive sport you could possibly choose. And to be fair, I thought that I really came down on that side of the argument that really there's no more inclusive sport than running. It's the simplest thing to do, to put a pair of shoes on and get out the door. But after speaking to various people and groups, it's clearly not. It's not. There's a lot of work to be done, and there is lots of good things that are being done. Obviously, there's a lot of work being done with women and with England Athletics. They are focusing on trying to change the makeup of coaching, and I know they're doing that. They've spoken out and they said they're sort of giving places to female coaches and stuff on coaching courses. But I think there's still a lot to be done, and I think they are dragging their feet a little bit in terms of kind of encouraging these people, because I think all they need, talking to Harminder last week, all they're asking for is a bit of help in a way, and a bit of help kind of getting a few free coaching courses. Because it's expensive. Like, if you were, I don't know, from, you never really, there's not really that many runners in your community. There's, it's not cheap. I think it's £250 for a coaching course to get on the initial coaching course qualification. It's not an easy thing to go and do, we need more coaches from within communities to encourage those to join and start running. And I think something's got to be, I know you can't cure the world's ills in a day, but there's certainly got to be more work to be done to encourage different groups.
Which is, I think. And what we can't do is like rely on the fact that because there are relatively limited barriers to get into it, as in, you know, cost barriers and logistics, because you can just pull on a pair of shoes and go out your front door and run. That though, and because we have this, the interesting thing about our sport is, you know, ultimately, if you play football and you play for a, particularly if you play for a team, but if you do it in any organised sense, you're kind of clearly taking part in a sport. The thing with running is there is that crossover between what is health and fitness for some people and then what is sport for other people. And that, and the lines are becoming increasingly grey. And for me, looking at it from a sports point of view, and those people who we want it to be as inclusive a sport as possible, so people to kind of get involved in competition and the communities that we have in our sport, we can't just go, look, because it's free or cheap, that means that we're inclusive, because it's deeper than that. It's a socio-cultural stuff. It's like, actually, inclusivity goes far deeper than just kind of practical barriers like cost, you know, and if we don't take a look at it, and kind of, as you rightly say, it's not about somebody like, you know, somebody from England Athletics or whatever being dropped into communities around the UK trying to activate things. It has to be about the coaches and the people activating wherever it is in the UK that happens. Otherwise it's not sustainable.
I was looking at reading about the sort of the big half, obviously run by the London Marathon Events, and I mean they're doing loads of good stuff in terms of for local people it starts in Greenwich, is a bit from local Londoners from different ethnic groups around London. They are offering cut price entry and all that sort of thing, and trying to encourage more people to do it, because the more stories, the more people you get out competing, the more likely they are that these guys are they're not going to become Olympic champions, these guys, but who knows if their kids aren't going to become Olympic champions, and if they're not going to encourage others from within the community to come and join in and spread our base of runners that are interested in competition. There's only a good thing for everybody, really. So get on. Good one, London Marathon Events. I think they're good at they're kind of trailblazers in terms of how they kind of reach out to different groups and get them interested in doing sort of the marathon and the big half. So yeah, all good. I think it's there's room to. There are exciting things going on. I think people just need to be made more aware of the exciting stuff that is going on. And like I was thinking of, we put Charlie Dark and Run Them Crew and Harminder, and Six in the City. But also, we didn't manage to speak to Alison Benton from AB Training Group down in Brighton. Now, she's doing an incredible job. Like, she's, I don't know a single athlete that's not under her tutelage who isn't going from, I don't know, running 2:35 to running 2:19, that they're having such success. And I think more needs to be made of these stories, like female coaches running incredible programs and you know, different ethnic communities doing great jobs at encouraging others from to come and run. We need to make more and more of these stories, and they should be bigger news than they are.
And I think that's a really important point, is that, you know, diversity can't just be about kind of entry level activity. Of course, that needs to be there. Like, there needs to be a foundation, but it can't just be about, well, let's get more women into being kind of run leaders. Of course, we need to do that. But there should also be the avenues, the support, the kind of progression routes for women, for more ethnic minorities to be coaching at a high performance level as well. Yeah. And to be fair to Alison, like, she's completely done that off her own back. And I know that she hasn't been without plenty of difficulties down there. I'm not getting into any sort of local club politics, but it's been very hard work, and because she's A, an incredibly talented coach, but B, a very strong character, but the thing that's really noticeable down there in that group is there a really a group that obviously really have a culture and an ethos that they all buy into, and you can tell that just from, I mean, I know quite a few of those guys, and there's a humbleness and a kind of a looking out for each other that those athletes do for each other, and that doesn't happen out of nothing. That culture has been grown by the athletes, but being kind of prodded in the right direction by a brilliant coach. But you know, not everybody has necessarily Alison's kind of strength of character to get through some of the barriers she's faced, and they shouldn't necessarily have to. So I think, yeah, definitely entry and community level stuff, but also the belief that there is kind of the routes to become, you know, coaching at a performance level, I think is really important.
Absolutely. And I think that's the thing. We need to make more of these stories, and I guess that's what we're trying to do, to try and highlight individual cases of people doing well. But obviously we're only a small podcast, that there's a lot more others can do to try and push it. I think running is just not a mainstream media sport now. We're not going to try and, you're not going to see articles in Daily Telegraph about running. Although there was one this year, I think when Tom Fairbrother went the wrong way in an ultra running race, they featured that as an article, as a story in the Daily Telegraph. And you think, Jesus Christ, there's so many other stories you want to pick up and talk about, inspiring stories in the world of running. That's not one of them. Anyway, I'm getting onto the wrong neck of the woods. But hey,
well, yeah, it's been really good. Particularly, I think in that case, because Tom had specifically said, please don't cover this. Hey ho.
Anyway, it's been really good, and we're really looking forward to the next set of interviews. So we've got a really exciting new feature, new kind of theme to start off in January, and we're going to be looking at running and mental health. So we kind of want to hear your stories. We want you to email. You can get in touch at letsgetrunning.co.uk. You can send us a WhatsApp recorded line. So that's a really interesting way of sending like a little thought. We'll try and play them out online, which should be quite good. I'll give you the number now. Bear with me. It's a Dutch number, but you can add it on WhatsApp, and it's not going to cost you anything to send a recorded message to. The number is +31 612 679 529, and just leave a message about, or again, email it. Yeah, I'm not asking you to just call in if you're embarrassed about that, but about your sort of mental health stories, how running has helped, perhaps, or maybe has running hindered your mental health? Have you become addicted to numbers, races, results? I think there's a certain cases like Strava addiction, and trying to make sure everything looks pristine and brilliant on Strava. The old Twitter page, Strava Wankers, which has, you know, these guys posting all sorts of weird stuff on Strava. So that there is a downside to modern day running, let's say. So we want to hear your stories, your perspectives on that, and we're going to discuss them. Gonna have Robbie Britton. If you've heard of Robbie, he is an ultra runner. He's got some He's been recently doing some 24-hour racing. You can check out his progress on fast running this month. Did he manage to do it, Tommy? He had a bit of a knee injury, didn't he?
Yeah, he has had some ongoing, actually he's had some on, sort of ongoing hip and knee problems for years and years and years. But this year has been a bit, it's flared up a few times. So he went into the race basically off the back of cycling training, and his knee was niggling when he started. So I no, he didn't. He stopped, and Robbie will be able to tell you exactly when it was, but he stopped relatively early in the race, unfortunately. It was a long trip to go because it was in the States, and it was his birthday. Oh. It was his birthday the next day, so but this is that sport, isn't it? That happens. Happened to the best of us. Robbie's one thing I'd say about Robbie, and I haven't been coaching him for long, really, just think year and a half. One thing I'd say about Robbie is that it relates maybe to the theme you're talking about next month, is he is very, very good at putting negatives behind him, kind of learning from them and then moving forward in a positive way. So if he has a poor session or a poor race, it doesn't carry through to the next 2, 3, 4 races or sessions. He is very good at kind of going, that was what it was. I'm going to learn from it and do things to change, but it's not going to affect what I'm going to do going forward. And that is actually a really rare skill to have. I can definitely say it's a skill I don't have.
me too.
So,
me too.
I'd say, he's got a few bits and pieces to work on around the rehab, conditioning, strength. But, knowing Robbie, he will put in place what he needs to put in place, and he'll have a great year next year. So,
great stuff. So you'll hear from him next month. The first show is going to be on January the 8th. So please get in touch with all those stories, maybe some questions for Robbie, questions for me. My mental health is anyway, well, let's not go too deep into that, but anything you want to talk to, as always, please share the show anyway you can do that. We often put posts up on Twitter, on Let's Get Running, on Instagram or Facebook, and we always like to hear your reviews. So if you anywhere you go on Apple, a podcast, or anywhere else, please leave a review. We love 5-star reviews, and we'll try and read those out on next time on the show. So yeah, I'll leave you to your final Christmas Day preparations, Tom.
If only they were the final ones. It's I work best under pressure. Let's just put it like that. That's my justification for leaving Christmas to the very last minute. I make my best decisions when I'm under pressure. At least I'll keep telling myself that until one year I get organised and start it earlier. So now, thank you, mate. Yeah. Enjoy your run. Like, if I'd known you'd been going, I was out with Louise and Chris this morning. If I'd known you were in Dorset, I'd have invited you down. You would have fancied 12 by a K. I'm absolutely sure.
Oh my God, I wouldn't have been able to live with those guys this morning. I think I'd have struggled, but next time I'm back in the Emerald, I was gonna say the Emerald Isle, the I don't know what you call Dorset, but next time I'm back in the Shire, I'll give you a shout when I have to get a session going.
Always welcome.
So I didn't tell us about our interview. So the first one is with Kirstine Welsh. Now Kirstine is a trail runner. She's really new to the sport, really interesting story about how she came to start running, which is going to come up in a second. We're going to talk to her about mainly because I put a tweet out on Twitter and asking sort of our listenership, our readers, if they knew of any non-white female GB runners over the last 10 to 20 years. And the only one that could be named, or the only two that could be named, are Hannah Walker and Kirstine Welsh. So it'd be good. I thought it'd be good to chat to her experience. And it's interesting because she is fairly new to the sport, her take on that. So we're going to talk to her first. Then we're going to talk to Gary Laybourne. So Gary Laybourne is part of an incredible enterprise called Coach Corps. Now Gary's going to explain it better than I can right now, but essentially they're looking at young people who have maybe fallen off the out of the traditional education system, who basically need an opportunity. So they give them, sort of empower them through coaching qualifications, and they find different apprenticeships within the sporting world that they can go into following their training. So quite an inspiring project, and he'll talk more about that and from a diversity standpoint there. So he's going to come up, and he's going to come after Kirstine. So here we go. On today's show, we are talking to mountain runner or trail runner. I'm not sure which is the best definition, but mountain runner Kirstine Welch. How are you doing, Kirstine?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, very well. I'm looking forward to coming down to your neck of the woods. You're down in the southwest of England. I'm on my way tomorrow on a flight to Exeter. So.
Yeah, it's beautiful down here. Yeah,
good
come
stuff.
And enjoy it.
Good stuff. And you're we'll talk about your running. Maybe you are fairly new to running. You haven't been sort of competing at the, let's say, the top level for very long. How did you get started in the sport?
It's a pretty crazy story, actually. In November last year, I took part in a charity fundraising challenge for the charity I work for, Guide Dogs.
Yeah.
And the challenge was to run as many miles as you can in a week. I initially wasn't going to do it, but my colleague put me forward for it. And while still working full time, I ran 200 miles in that week.
Wow.
And unbeknownst to me, one of the colleagues that had been following all my runs, you had to upload them onto Strava. She used to be an international ultra runner. And she sent me this really lovely email just saying, I don't know how you managed to run 200 miles in that week. And I know many sponsored Salomon athletes that struggle to run 140 miles and that I've clearly got some natural talent there and to kind of take my running a bit more seriously. And yeah, that's how it all started, really.
Wow. And how did you feel after 200 miles? Were you absolutely knackered, or did you manage to run the next week?
I think I took one day off. It's weird. Like before then, I'd call myself a recreational runner. So I just run a few miles after work with my dog.
Yeah.
Never did any training, didn't enter any races. So it was, a shock to me to run 200 miles. But, in the weekend I did two back-to-back 40-mile runs. And a long run for me before that was maybe 10 miles. So yeah. I don't know how I did it, to be honest. But now I felt okay. I felt tired, obviously. But, just clearly got some good endurance in me.
What was the next step then? After she kind of said that you've got a bit of talent, what did you then do to then pursue that?
A friend that I know, she's knows a GB ultra running coach, and she got in touch with him. He chatted to me on the phone and just told him all about, you know, my history and stuff, and he agreed to take me on, which was really fortunate.
Great.
And he has been coaching me then up until the World Mountain Running Championships. And again, when I first started with him, I was training for a Manchester Marathon, a sub 3 hours. So all my training was on the road.
Yeah.
And I got injured in February and had to stop running for a month, and then gradually reintroduced running. And the running I did do had to be off-road on the trails and stuff. Once I was back, kind of fairly injury-free, I just started entering a few local races to get my fitness back up, and I was winning them and setting course records and stuff. And that's when he was like, oh, you're clearly good at this trail running stuff. So how do you feel about running Snowdon Marathon, which was a GB trial race for the World Mountain Running Championship?
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I'll go for it. And we didn't think at all that I'd ever be selected. I mean, I'd never run up a mountain before, so that was my first time ever running up a mountain. I mean, Devon has hills, but no mountains. So
yeah,
it was a shock to my legs, to be honest. But I honestly can't believe it. Well, I came first, and that got me selected to go to Argentina. So
wow. So let's look at this time together. So from that charity week of 200 miles to GB selection, how short was that period?
Well, the Snowdon Marathon was in July this year. So maybe about, 6 months? Seven months. And then so it's a pretty big leap, and I think I missed the stage. Normally you go represent England first at something before you then go on and represent Great Britain. So I kind of skipped the stage there. But it's been a pretty crazy year, to be honest.
And what's it been like? So obviously you have a talent for this, but is it kind of almost help that you're a bit green, that you don't really know what you're doing, let's say, you just go out there and run? Do you think that's an advantage to you at the moment?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, it was early on in the year, no one knew me, so there was no expectation. You know, you're standing on the start line, no one knows you. Yeah, but I think even, you know, now already people are starting to kind of realise who I am, so there's a bit more expectation then, and obviously that adds pressure and nerves and stuff.
Yeah. What was it like in Snowdon? So did you go in there thinking, how did you approach that kind of race? You've never done a mountain marathon, really. How did you go? What was your tactics? Did you have any tactics? How did the race plan out that led to your victory?
The tactic was just to kind of stick with the front runners and just see how it goes. But that kind of went out the window because at the beginning I felt the pace was a bit slow. So maybe about a mile in, I took the lead, and then I ended up keeping the lead for the whole race, just thinking the whole time, oh, someone's going to overtake me, someone's going to overtake me. And they didn't. So, because I'm quite new to all this running, I'm not very good at pacing myself. So I do always go out too hard, which was the case in that one. But I went out so hard that I ended up getting a good lead that no one could catch me, even when I did slow down at the end.
That's amazing. So pulling on that vest then, so you obviously went out, I myself was trying to qualify for that in the short course, right? But I had some health injuries and stuff, so I didn't make it. But what was it like? Like donning the GB vest for the first time, like within a year of really thinking about this, taking up this sport. What was that like going out there with the GB team? Like, describe the experience.
Just so weird, but amazing at the same time. I mean, didn't really know what to expect. Obviously really, really nervous. And obviously being the winner off the trial, I think there was maybe more expectation that, oh, okay, that's the one good one to look out for. And yeah, I think knowing then that I was going to be representing Great Britain and Argentina, like the trainings between July, the trial race, and then November, which was the GB race, I'd been training too hard, and you know, of the nerves were building, and the, you know, quite a bit of pressure and stuff. And
yeah,
I think that all culminated in, you know, a bad race in the World Championships. But I think it's all a learning curve and a learning process. You know, figuring out how much training your body can handle, how much is too much. You know, making sure, you know, you're getting the recovery, you're fueling right. Yes, but I mean, yeah, Argentina was, I mean, glorious. I went out there, flew out there 2 weeks before the race.
Yeah.
I could get used to the altitude and kind of recce the course and stuff. And it was, yeah, really nice kind of, you know, hooking up with the other GB athletes and running with them. I've got so much tips and knowledge from them as well, which will help me going forward.
Yeah.
So since then, I've got a new coach now who's more specialised in, I still don't know what I'm going to focus on in 2020, but I don't really want to do the ultra distance running. So, my previous coach, that was his specialism. So,
right. Who is the coach now? Who is your coach?
Alan Story.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, good hands with him, and going forward, just having a team of people around me. I've got Renee McGregor. She's my dietitian, and then Holly Rush. She's going to help me with the strength and conditioning side. Which I haven't been doing at all last year. So, yeah, hoping 2020 will be more successful. We'll see.
This is an incredible rise. Like, obviously, you were doing a bit of running before you said you'd do, you know, a 10-mile run and stuff. Were you doing anything else to keep yourself in shape? Because you must have had a really good level of fitness. Have you played sports, different sports, when you were a teenager or anything? Or was it just running for you, recreational running for you, but until this point?
No, I mean, I've always been very sporty growing up. I drove my parents mad, to be honest. I kind of throw myself into anything. So I think kind of when I was younger in school and stuff, would be like football. I did back in 2011, I think I joined my local athletics club for a year. And trained with them. But yeah, I mean, I do surfing, snowboarding, horse riding, tennis, you know, any kind of sport, I'll give it a go. So yeah, mountain biking. So I think that all kind of helped kind of build up a general base level of fitness. I'm always on the go.
And then whereabouts? So you're living now in Devon. Where did you grow up? Where was home as a teenager?
Teenager was Milton Keynes.
Okay.
City.
Was there running a thing there? Was there opportunities for you to run as a teenager? Or was it just nothing, something you didn't consider?
Not so much. I mean, it was in Milton Keynes that I joined my local athletics club, but and that was a good club. I trained was about four times a week with a group of people. But I only did that for a year, and then I moved away and went to university. And then, since then and now, you know, I did continue running, but, you know, no structure. It was just, you know, a few miles here and there when I felt like it, and, you know, going out running with my dog on a daily basis and stuff. And then just take a part in kind of like other hobbies and stuff, like the surfing and the mountain biking and snowboarding. And now that I'm taking my running more seriously, all my other sports and hobbies have taken a back seat. Like, I've got no energy or time to go surfing or whatever like that. So it's literally just running at the moment.
Great.
But, yeah.
And a bit of like, we've spoken about this before on email and a little bit about kind of the reason I kind of got in touch with you is because we're doing a focus at the moment about sort of diversity in running and inclusion is the other diversity. I don't know if you can match those up together, but I asked our Twitter followers if they could name a non-white female endurance runner for GB in England over the last 30 years. And amazingly, there was only your name and Hannah Walker, who we've already interviewed, actually.
That's crazy.
That came up. And did you know that? Is that something that was that you were aware of?
No, not at all. I had absolutely no idea.
Yeah.
I mean, I kind of knew, especially when it comes to like the trail running and mountain running scene, it is predominantly white people.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that is. But yeah, I didn't realise it was so low, especially when it comes to kind of, you know, GB athletes. Yeah, I had no idea.
Yeah. But do you think, so being outside of, you're in an area now that you are, obviously trail running is, it's kind of what you do because it's you can't run at night on these roads and half the roads are pretty dangerous to run on. So you're going to run trail.
Yeah.
If you had lived in Milton Keynes, do you think you'd ever have known about the mountain running or the trail running scene at all? Would that have
probably
been...
not?
Yeah.
Probably not, because Milton Keynes, you know, you had lots of cycle paths and stuff that you know you'd run on, and you know, the club was, you know, you either a track runner or you're a road runner.
Yeah.
You know, none of this kind of trail running stuff. So no, I probably, if I'd continued living there, I probably wouldn't have even. I mean, to be fair, I didn't even know there was such a thing as the World Mountain Running Championships until this year. So, so yeah, it's all pretty new to me.
Yeah, and so it is incredibly white trail running, even more so probably than marathon running, half marathons, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Do you notice, I guess the Southwest is a particularly sort of white area of the country. Do you notice when you turn up that you are one of only two or three sort of non-white runners in the race? Is that very noticeable?
It's never really crossed my mind.
Right.
And I think it's probably because, you know, like you say, Devon is, you know, predominantly a lot of white people. And even in my job, like, you know, I'm the only non-white person, but I've never felt, you know, been made to feel different or awkward because of it. I've always, and even with the running, I've always been included, you know, regardless. And, you know, when you're standing on the start line, you're not, I listened to, the last podcast you did and the interview you did and he was saying, you know, like he mentioned something about standing on the start line and looking around and, you know, being maybe the only non-white person there might not feel you know, so good. But actually I'm thinking of other stuff. I'm thinking of, oh, that, you know, that's a good athlete over there, you know, I want to kind of stick with them, or, you know, maybe what they're thinking of me, or you're just concentrating on your race. But I've never felt, you know, been made to feel awkward or different about it, so I suppose it's never really crossed my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. And does that extend to kind of when you're going and representing GB abroad? Did you? It is quite a white sport. Did you notice? Obviously, I suppose in the World Championships, did you notice were you one of any one or two non-white runners there too?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely obvious. you know, you just look around and there's, you know, just white people everywhere. But again, you know, it didn't really kind of cross my mind as, you know, that I would be at any kind of disadvantage because of it. Or, yeah, I think I'd read somewhere that, you know, maybe not necessarily with GB, but, you know, a lot of, you know, the really good endurance runners, you know, looking at, you know, the Kenyans and Ethiopians and, you know, the question was, why are they not doing the World Mountain and trail running? And probably because there's more money in the road running. I don't know, but yeah, when it comes to GB, I don't know, because, you know, Great Britain is a diverse country. So yeah, maybe it is dependent on where people grow up and things like that. Like you say, if it wasn't in Devon, I, you know, wouldn't have ever, you know, considered or even known about trail and mountain running. So but yeah, no, I it never really crossed my mind, and I've never been made to feel any different about it, which is good.
Yeah.
Actually, I think probably my dad's Jamaican. I'm a weird mix, and my mum's German.
Yeah.
So I think it's probably, you know, I've got some natural genes in me, so it probably benefits me having that that mix with my parents and stuff. So.
But I think it's quite interesting that, like, cases like cut yours. My previous co-host Jermaine, who's now got 2 minutes staff on, he can't join. He's Jamaican, but he's also part Jamaican and an endurance runner. But if people with Jamaican heritage growing up in the UK would tend to think immediately, I'm fast, I'm a sprinter. That there's you don't hear enough is made of stories like yours, maybe like Jermaine's, like that. That is a possibility, because obviously endurance running as a lifestyle is great for physical, mental health, and that sort of thing should be encouraged. But because people of Jamaican heritage wouldn't think that's kind of the sport for them, perhaps they're not going to do it. And it's hard to know how to encourage stories like that. But I think, and your particular story, the fact that you can go from just doing a bit of running, discover this mountain running scene, and just absolutely fly. So there's so much potential for people to get more people to try these different sports out, and actually to be encouraged to show that your sorts of people can do that. That sounds, what I'm trying to say. I'm fluffing over my words, but people of your Jamaican heritage or of where or any heritage can do it, and there are examples of people doing it and succeeding. So
yeah, I think you're definitely right there. I was nobody. I didn't think I had any talent, and just, suddenly out of nowhere, within a year, I then represented Great Britain. Yeah. And I'm quite honest, on social media and Instagram and stuff about, my journey and the highs and the lows. And I love the fact that I'm, encouraging people, to take up running. There's quite a few people at work now that never ran before, and they've taken up running because of me, and they're really loving it, and they're entering their first 5K races and 10K races, and that's awesome. If I can encourage people to kind of, give it a go, whether even if it's just a health benefit, or like you said, they might find some natural talent within them that's not being discovered. Then that makes me super happy. So
great. So what does the future hold then? So Alan Story is traditionally a marathon running coach, I'd have said.
Yeah.
Where does your future lie? Do you want to stay on the trails, or are you looking to the road? What would you like to do over the next sort of 5 or 6 years to build on the start you've made?
Well, like you said before, Jamaicans, quite often, they're the really good sprinters. And interesting, Alan Story, right back at my history and stuff. So when I did the track, the athletic club for a year, back in 2011, when I trained my athletic club for a year, I did a 100 meter race there. It was just basically, there was no one else to do the race, so I was like, okay, fine, I'll do it. And I think I did 15 seconds, which doesn't mean anything to me, but he said that indicates that there might be some speed in my legs.
Right.
And that part of me hasn't been explored yet. Like, I've only been doing it for a year, and I kind of jumped straight into the kind of endurance side of stuff.
Yeah.
I haven't really had a chance to explore maybe my speed and, taking part in shorter distance races. So he kind of just mentioned that. I've got a London Marathon Championship entry, so I've never done a road marathon before. So looking to maybe get a good time in London Marathon in April. Yeah. We're not sure what our plans are for 2020. It may be that I continue with the trail and mountain stuff, because that's clearly what I'm good at. Maybe that we explore a bit more, what I'm like and my potential over the shorter, faster stuff or the road stuff. We'll see. I'll leave it kind of up to him. Fine.
And what is training like at the moment then? But previously, I guess you were just getting out and covering a lot more distance. Have you started to do some more sessions and things? Are you now working a bit more on sort of various different things with Alan?
Training's a lot more different now. Like you said before, with my ultra coach before, I was just kind of going out and running a lot of miles.
Yeah.
And a kind of steady pace. But now I'm doing a lot more kind of specialised stuff. So I'm back training on the track now every Tuesday.
Yeah.
Doing kind of tempo runs, longer runs with tempo bits in between them. And then obviously a lot of easy running in between. So it's really nice having kind of the mix of training, a different training session each week. And it kind of mixes it up and keeps you interested. And I'm enjoying kind of pushing my body and seeing what it's capable of and getting faster. So yeah, it's nice to have kind of a different side of running now with Alan.
Great.
So enjoying that.
And as a, I was going to say that it's, if there's any place to go and cover miles, it's a coast down in Devon. Is there a particular bit you like? My wife, we're from kind of down the same region. I remember once we went to a wedding down in Seaton, and it was, she ran from, I think it's either Seaton to Beer or the other way around. And it was on a summer morning and it was beautiful sun. And she said, it's the first time ever I've stopped and nearly cried on a run because it was so nice. What is your favourite bit of that coast? Have you got a particular part you love running on?
I'd say it's probably the coast path between Sidmouth and Beer. I mean, Beer is lovely to run on. Yeah. There's been, you know, plenty of times when I've been running along the coast path and like it might be early in the morning and the sun's rising or the sun's setting and it's just beautiful. And you go running along, you have tears in your eyes because it's so beautiful. I've got my dog running in front of me and running's no hardship. I mean, the hills are a nightmare, but.
that's what you got to do, those hills if you want to compete as a mountain runner. Eh? That's it.
I know, exactly.
Yeah. I've stupidly decided to, I've been doing the mountain running while training in Amsterdam, which is the world's flattest city. So, yeah, that's a bit stupid. With you, I can see why you went for that. But with me, it's just, I think I need my head tested. But anyway, these things happen. And I should finish off, I shouldn't keep you too much longer, but I should finish off with a couple of quick questions.
Go for it.
And the first one is, if you could be anywhere running now, where would it be?
Probably back in Patagonia. Yeah, I mean, the trails there are just stunning. Absolutely beautiful. You've got the mountains, the snow on top, the amazing lakes, the forests. Yeah, back in Patagonia, definitely.
Beautiful. And can you recommend our listeners something? So it could be a book, film, experience that you've tried. I guess mountain running is quite an experience that you've taken to, but have you got anything else apart from that?
I was recommended a book. It's called Training for the Uphill Athlete. As recommended by Jonathan Alban when I was out in Argentina. And I've been reading it and it's really, really interesting book. And it doesn't just have to be for mountain or trail runners. I think any kind of running, because it goes into detail about, you know, different kinds of training and what stimulus it has in the body, all about, like, you know, overtraining, strength training, recovering, all about aerobic capacity. So I'm a bit of a running nerd. I like kind of going in depth into all kind of the background of, you know, the body and what's happening inside it and why we do different sessions. And so I'm finding it that really interesting reading that. So Training for the Uphill Athlete, if anyone's interested.
One. We'll put a link to that. I think John Alban might recommend that one before, but I didn't go and get it. So now that's been two recommendations. Oh, I've got to go and get it now.
Yeah,
that's the rule. If it's recommended twice, I have to read it. So that's my Christmas reading, I think.
You'll enjoy it.
And the last one is what, in your opinion, is the greatest endurance running performance of all time?
It's got to be Kipchoge's sub-2-hour marathon, definitely.
Yeah.
And he's so humble and he's so, with his training, you know, he doesn't overdo it. He listens to his body, takes time out and he doesn't run when it needs to be. And he focuses on, you know, certain races throughout the year and that's his focus. And, you know, he trains hard and then in the lead up to it. So, yeah, I think, you know, his performance just proves, you know, that, you know, nothing's impossible when you put your mind to it. You just got to knuckle down, do some hard work, believe you can do it and have a great team of people around you. So, yeah. Definitely.
So it sounds like you kind of learned from that experience of Patagonia and you're ready to move on and hit the next target, I think. It sounds like you're quite a, you're making all the right steps to take yourself to the next level as an athlete, which is exciting, really.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Learning a lot about running and my body at the same time. And yeah, learning from it, moving on, made the mistake, let's move on. And I really want to, I'm the kind of person, I don't want to do something half-heartedly. I want to either give it my all or not bother at all. So
yeah,
I've decided, you know, let's give this whole running malarkey a go and see where I can get to, how good I can get. We'll see.
And manage that very awkward, like, kind of a line between pushing yourself really hard and gaining or over tipping and going the other way and doing too much. It's a hard one to manage, but I think if you've got kind of a good coach behind you, you can, that's the best step to take.
Exactly. Yeah. Like you said, it's such a fine line. But, you know, I've got a good team of people around me, so I think I'm in good hands.
Great. Fantastic. Well, we'll be looking out for you keenly. Hopefully you'll inspire a few more half Jamaicans to get out there and run long. They can sprint. Definitely. It helps, obviously, if you're fast, it helps with the endurance. Do you know what I mean?
Like, 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, the amount of times I've, you know, been maybe in second or third and pulled out a sprint finish to come first. So definitely get out there and run. And, it, you know, it doesn't matter where you run or how far you run. Just get out there and you'll find you enjoy it. And, you know, if it's, you know, the social aspect you like, join a club. I'm really loving my sessions on a Tuesday now because I'm running with other athletes and it's nice to have that social side because quite often I'm running on my own. But some people, you know, like to run on their own because it's escapism. And just get out there and run. It's so lovely. You get to see lovely places, meet lovely people. Just don't worry about anyone else standing on that start line or around you, because I don't, you know, in my experience, no one's ever said anything, or I've never had any, you know, bad feelings or comments. You know, running is a community and everyone's in it together, and it's actually, you know, really social, and I've met so many lovely people. So
great, fantastic. Well, thanks Kirstine, thanks for your time, and good luck over the next few months of training.
Thank you, good luck with you, and it's lovely talking.
As an additional interview, we're speaking to friend of the show, Gary Laybourne. How are you doing, Gary?
Very well, thank you, Sean. You okay?
I'm very good, yeah. And you've got quite a background in endurance sports. I've recently run a 69-minute half marathon, but you've competed over various different endurance sports, including running at Kona, or competing at Kona for triathlon last year, and being the European aquathlon gold medalist.
Yeah, indeed. So, as ever, we start in one, fan out into other sports as triathletes. So I was a track runner for a number of years as a junior, went into triathlon, had some good national success, and then went into, had a decent run of a couple of years, and then ended with the Ironman in 2018, but have come very firmly with my tail back between my legs to running in the last sort of 12, 18 months. So,
yeah. But we're here actually to talk about Coach Corps. So we'll have a chat about, because obviously we're still looking at diversity and sort of how diverse is our sport, and I guess society is pretty it's a place where we could have more diversity as well. So we'll talk a bit about Coach Corps. Firstly, sort of take us back to the beginning. How did it come into being? What was your original idea for Coach Corps?
So, I mean, essentially, as ever with some of the best laid plans, it was just right place, right time. I mean, my CEO at the time of the charity that I was working at held the pen on a paper called More Than a Game. And that was commissioned by the CSJ, the Centre for Social Justice, off the backdrop of the London riots. And then, long story short, essentially that was saying, if you look, walk, talk, are from a certain demographic, your future life chances are going to be extremely limited, and why not use sport, particularly with the upcoming 2012 games, as a catalyst to change that? And that chimed because our CEO, we were very fortunate that he listened greatly to his head coach staff and his staff developers on the ground. And we were bemoaning the fact that the model that the charity that I was working at, Greenhouse, is that we have head coaches based in really challenging parts of London from sun up to sundown. So not just coming in once or twice a week, as is the normal model, but we'd be based there and we'd be doing as much mentoring and personal development as we were, you know, as decent level qualified coaches. Mm. But the problem was that we would, you know, spend up to sort of 5-6 years helping develop some of these young people and keeping them on the straight and narrow. But then, you know, knowing that post 16, that those options still weren't great. So not feeling particularly good about that, but also bemoaning the fact that in our sector, as we know, it's, you know, incredibly volunteer led, very transient part-time workforce. So we wanted to kind of put the two together. It's to say, why can't we have our future next generation workforce come from the people that we're shaping and working with constantly? And therefore, who better to sort of live and breathe our values, but also critically, who better to be a role model in the local community than someone from the local community? So for us, it was, you know, great. It was improving their life chances and, you know, really opening the diversity of future workforce. But also, very selfishly and cynically as an employer, it's great because we've got them in full time, working on all our sessions and being a real asset to the business.
Right. OK, so just got to sort of describe what sort of happens. So young people come to you and what do you provide for them?
So essentially, I mean, the basics is that we will give them a level two. So we are targeting NEETs. So those young people that are 16 plus that are not in education or employment, you know, may have had a checkered past, may struggle with traditional educational settings, that kind of stuff. So again, by its very nature of where we're working and targeting, when we first launched in 2012 in London, we would pick up those young people, and it was saying to them, look, we'll give you a level two apprenticeship in sport, which is obviously a GCSE, five GCSE equivalent, and we'll give you a minimum of a level two qualification. But again, the fortunate part of this is that myself as a coach since 17 and a number of the peers that I was working with, we all believed in, you know, whilst, for example, I, you know, as a track and field coach, I still believed that I was getting some of my best drills from other sports and working with other coaches from different backgrounds and different, you know, right through to the things that I learned about religion and things like that. So we would very much place the technical coaching skills we still do today as a secondary. So they're going to get a tangible qualification. They're going to get to, you know, become a qualified coach, but we're going to add so much to their CV and their development across the space of a 12 to 18 month period of time. And we're placing high quality, good coaching, learning, positive environments, that kind of stuff at the heart of everything we do, and using their own sports to just bring that to life rather than the other way around. And as I say, we piloted that in three different areas. So London started us off, and then very quickly we had Glasgow and South Wales. So three very different education systems, three very different organisations, all under the umbrella of the Royal Foundation of William, Harry and Catherine, that really wanted to sort of create a 2012 legacy programme of sport for young people. And fortunately, it paid dividends. You know, we've become hugely successful. We got to scale it up over 10 sites and work much more strategically to kind of where we are current day, and really sort of going out there and saying to young people, look, you know, sport can be a hell of a career for you, but critically saying to other sectors as well as our own, apprenticeship should absolutely start to become the norm for some of the young people that we work with.
Great. And then how's it work with employers then? Have you had kind of much support through various organizations getting involved to offer apprenticeships?
Yeah. So again, that sort of proving of concept. So the piloting was 2012 to 2015. And then I had 3 years. So that's when I came in full time. I was running the London project, but then came in to oversee the sort of national scale up, if you will. So I wanted to take it to 10 sites around the UK. I realized that we needed to do that quickly. But critically, I also realized that what we needed to do was ensure that we were allowing each of these sites to take ownership for it. So as you know, an original Devon lad and stuff, it's a case of saying what might work down in Devon isn't going to work in London, isn't going to work in Manchester. So we need to hand that ownership over to that group of employers. So what we would do is we understood that by targeting the certain learners that we want to open this opportunity up to, yes, it has all of these positive effects, but we know that that comes with a bit of a challenge to the employer. So we would fundraise a little bit to help offset some of the salary costs and the training costs that we want to put in place. Over time, it was a case of saying, well, look, let's work with some of the national governing bodies. Let's work with some of the big recognisable sporting clubs and their community trusts to take on these young people. But actually, we found really quickly that, you know, in most of the places, it was the one man, one woman band that had, you know, was taking on their second or third employee that was interested. It was the leisure centre that was saying, well, we're fed up with giving out our facilities to loads of different people. Let's have our own in-house coach and give it to someone from the local community. So these consortiums actually started to become really far reaching across the sector. So not just traditional coaching providers, but actually anyone that's using sport and is community facing, right through to, you know, we've worked with drug addiction charities that use sport, elderly care services looking for their next generation of carers through sport and physical activity. So we're really trying to open the diversity piece to employers by saying, look, you know, don't draw from the same workforce. Well, just because someone's been to university doesn't mean they're going to come with life lived and all of these different experiences from some of the estates and things that you want to, you know, influence change into. So, you know, right through to more recently now, where we've started to have national governing bodies themselves come in and say, not only do we need to start getting involved with this program and working with our clubs and networks to do this, but actually we've even had some national governing bodies take on Coach Corps apprentices as part of the sort of city consortiums as well.
That's fantastic. So how many cities are you guys in now?
So we're in 13 currently, and it'll be 17 moving forward. So akin to everything that happens within the Royal Foundation, you kind of give birth to something, you incubate it and you grow it. And if it served its purpose, then, you know, you wind it down. But I mean, poster child for us is Invictus Games and Heads Together and a number of other programs that have come from the foundation. And fortunately for us, as Coach Corps was the very, you know, the first program for their Royal Highnesses, we've now shown that we've got the impact to become our own charity. So we, as of next year, will start to take Coach Corps away, become its own charity in its own right. I mean, the stats are ridiculous. I think we were met with a lot of skepticism when we first started this, that it would be, you know, a nice thing to do or something like that. But I mean, we've had over 500 apprentices now, nearly 150 odd employers around the country. And then last year alone, that was, these guys were either assisting or leading over 40,000 coaching sessions with over 600,000 coaching interactions. And that's all from
great,
young, diverse, you know, new future workforce that we're able to shape and mold and, you know, are breaking sort of the mold, shall we say, of what a traditional employee might look like for many people. But critically, it's that ripple effect. It's that what they're going on into those communities to do. So, yeah, it'll be 17 cities by September of next year. And we're just hoping that we can really change how people perceive what young people can do. I think that's one of the big things for us is that the nicest thing for me is always the surprise. People new to Coach Corps, it's the surprise of what young people are prepared to do to give back to their own communities. So there's this stigma that they just take, or that they're lazy or whatever. But actually, with how much they're putting back into the community with community projects is absolutely incredible. And secondly, it's the economic stuff. I mean, there's two folds to it, really. I mean, one, as a sector, we're still not embracing this as the norm. We're still getting people paying ridiculous amounts for assistant coaches and stuff when they could be developing an apprentice for the long term. And I found it really interesting in the last show when you were talking to Harminda, when he was talking about ethnic barriers. And of course, you know, we see that all the time. But I still feel that it's more the economic barriers that are being thrown up. It's more the fact that, you know, in our sport, it costs, you know, 250 quid to go and be a level one assistant coach. I mean, it's madness. Yeah. And on that time, it's a matter of, you know, 2 days, 3 days or something that they get to do. You know, we're just throwing up too many barriers for people to get involved with coaching and be that sort of future generation workforce. So, yeah, I think there's a number of things that we're looking to do with the project and particularly, you know, how we can help with things like social prescribing and community interaction projects, I think is really exciting for us going forward.
Great, because for most people that have been involved with not just running but any sport, is you learn so much from your involvement and you learn so much from becoming a coach and helping other people, and the skills you draw from that are really incredible. Like I don't think I would be the same person without my involvement in running throughout my life. And there are traditions, you said most of these guys that are coming through the system are perhaps guys that have fallen out of the traditional education system. It doesn't work for everybody. Like, and it is incredible to patch those two together, to give them these kind of just empower them with the skills they're going to gain through coaching, but also to find a way to get them to channel their enthusiasm. Really incredible.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the key things, again, that we're looking to try and really show is that so many people give up on them. I mean, speaking from my own personal experience, coaching for as many years as I have, I can honestly count on one hand the amount of kids that I knew were just not going to make it. You know, they were either going to end up in real, you know, trouble with the law or even worse. The rest of them, they just didn't respond to the environment that was put in front of them. And I mean, and who does in life? By giving them something that, and again, given who we're targeting and where we're targeting and stuff, they can't afford to go to uni even if they wanted to. So by actually saying to them, look, we're going to give you employment, we're going to let you really make an impact, not on your own, just on your own life, but the employers around you, the community around you for the next sort of 12 to 18 months. You know, I think it's really key, but it's getting people to just think a little bit laterally as well. I mean, again, our key targets are that these guys go into full-time education employment. That's it. If it's as a head coach and as a coach itself, then wonderful, but that's not the target here. We're using that as the hook for all those points that you just mentioned, Sean. It's the fact that they're going to develop resilience and confidence and personal skills because we are mentoring and tutoring them in such a different way compared to the traditional model. And again, drawing on other sports, drawing on other experiences. You know, we've been even saying to athletics is a prime example where you've got, look, I love the concept, but it's a volunteer sport. I think that's such a lazy answer. It's a case of saying, well, hang on a second, your local leisure centre is someone that's trying to get more people active and more, you know, and get more people healthier. So why can't they, as part of their 30 hours a week, be an athletics coach for you 3 evenings a week, and then you support them as personal trainers? Why can't you be the central base of employment for them, let them do their athletic development in schools, and you're going to get them more people coming through your centres? It just goes round and round and round how closed off people think about coaching and workforce and sport in general in some cases. So, in our very own small way, working with the number of partners, because essentially that's what Coach Core is doing. It's about, we aren't the education provider, we aren't the employer, we're just bringing the right people together to really influence change across, workforce, crime, development, education, and just using, the fact that these young people are so hungry to change their own lives that they're going to have a massive positive impact on all the other people around them.
Fantastic. And if people kind of listening to this want to kind of support or get involved, is there a way people can help, or is there a way people can learn more about Coach Core?
Yeah, for sure. And thanks for throwing that up. So we have our website, which is wearecoachcore.com. And there's a Twitter site as well, We Are Coach Core. I'm forever banging on about stuff on my own channel at Gary Laybourne. Absolutely go and have a look at that. I think if there's anyone listening that has links to young people, we're always interested in pipelines of talent. So on the website, you'll see that there's recruitment areas, because the idea is that we're not here to launch something and then leave. Everything we do is to try and set up sustainable projects within each of the cities that we work in. So if you've got sight of young people that you think could be interested, there's always a recruitment page on the site. And then, of course, if it's aligns to any of the cities that we're working in, we're always interested in hearing from potential employers as well as part of these kind of working consortiums that we get going.
Fantastic. Great stuff. Well, it's very exciting. I was going to ask, has there been an example actually of a particular character that you think would be good to share with us that have succeeded through the program?
I'm going to be very biased. There's quite a few. I think there's one springs to mind. I mean, we've got a number of case studies. Again, Coach Core does have a YouTube channel that's got some case studies on there. If you're feeling like you need a pep in life, go and have a look at some of these guys and girls. They really will inspire you.
Absolutely.
There is one young lady who comes to mind, and I think it encapsulates all the kind of points that I talked about today, really. So she was mentored by a really good coach. So the role of a good positive coach is tick number one. She wanted to work in sport, but as a Muslim female, it was something that, culturally was not the norm and not really accepted per se. So she came onto the program, thankfully, through her own stubbornness and going against the wishes of her parents, who wanted her to go down a very different route. And she just massively succeeded. But not only did she succeed, and not just through the program, obviously it's testament to the people that are around her and that have really helped shape that journey. She's obviously gone on to do now a really positive thing, that she's gone to uni, but she's staying within the sports sector, which is great. But the community project that she set up, she actually got Muslim girls at primary age playing table tennis, and that's now a proper club that is thriving, despite the fact that she left 18 months ago. Great. So, it's just things like that. This is what I mean. It's just about understanding the potential of young people and letting them have that opportunity, because it's not that they're just going to sponge that and absorb it for themselves. So many times we see they will do so many great things for others as well.
Fantastic. Well, they're very inspired. I'm inspired this morning to get out for my run in a minute. I'll be having a think. Great stuff, Gary. Thanks a lot for explaining Coach Core to us, and good luck with your own running over the next 12 months.
Thanks very much, and thanks for giving us the opportunity to showcase it.
No trouble.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. from plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.